The Life and Line of Artist Keith Haring.
It takes him a while to figure out how to turn that line into the kind of signature that we recognize today, where he really, at a certain point, after being in New York for a couple of years, begins drawing his crawling baby and flying saucers and nuclear reactors, ziggurat stairways, and all this imagery that he then recombines and tells different stories with from then on. And they become his basic language or his vocabulary. But it's always this line that drives the work.
That's Brad Gooch. We talk with him about his acclaimed new biography of Keith Haring, Radiant. Then we listen back to a clip of Brad Gooch talking with us in 2017 about his biography, Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rihanna. In the 1980s, the subways of New York City were covered with art. In the stations, black matte sheets were pasted over outdated ads, and unsigned chalk drawings often popped up on these blank spaces. These temporary chalk drawings numbered in the thousands and became synonymous with a city as diverse as it was at war with itself, beset with poverty and crime, but alive with art and creative energy. And every single one of those drawings was done by Keith Haring. Haring was one of the most emblematic artists of the 1980s, part of an iconic cultural crowd that included Andy Warhol, Madonna, and Jean-Michel Basquiat. Haring broke down the barriers between high art and popular culture, creating work that was accessible for all and using it as a means to provoke and inspire radical social change. Haring died of AIDS in 1990. To this day, his influence on our culture remains. Brad Gooch's biography of Keith Haring, Radiant, brings the artist's brilliant but tragically short life to light, painting a vivid picture of the life and times of his subject. Gooch was granted access to Haring's extensive archive to write the biography, one that will become the authoritative work on the artist. Brad Gooch, welcome back to Writer's Voice. It's been 7 years, I believe.
Hi, Francesca. Good to be with you again.
So you are gay, no secret. We spoke with you in 2017 about your wonderful biography of the 13th century Sufi poet Rumi, who wrote many love poems to his male friend and beloved Shams of Tabriz. I doubt that anyone who isn't gay could have written such a deeply sensitive biography of Keith Haring as you have. What drew you to write about him?
Well, I think not just the gay part, but that I was in New York pretty much at the same time that he was, and then our paths kept crossing. So in 1978, when he arrives in New York, age 20, to come out and to go to SVA, School of Visual Arts, he's living in the East Village on First Avenue and First Street. A lot of the time I'm living on Bleecker and Bowery a lot of the time. And so I would come across first his artworks. I remember walking from the West Village to the East Village, my lover Howard Bruckner, and stamped on the curbs of streets going over in this kind of graphite was a sign that said "Clones Go Home" by this fake organization Keith had started, Fags Against Facial Hair. That was a kind of inside joke in the gay community. Then, you know, a little bit later, I'd start seeing crawling babies on a newsstand in Soho. And then he begins doing these subway drawings of his, chalk subway drawings that amount to 5,000 over 5 years. You know, so I certainly see those. But I would also run across him he supposedly came to a book party that Dennis Cooper and I gave for our books of stories in 1984. And I remember him, seeing him at the reopening of the Apollo, and kind of just as the lights were going down, coming with his posse and filling up this row with mainly Black and Latin men and women who looked fantastic. So he was kind of a scene maker in a very scenic time. Then my lover, Howard Bruckner, who I mentioned, got sick with AIDS, as so many people did later in the decade. Keith characteristically gave money for his care. And I remember seeing him at Howard's funeral in the back, looking kind of spooked, because he was within a year of his own death at that time. So he very much stayed with me as artist and presence. And I always had this idea I wanted to write a novel about Keith, especially in the 90s. It's hard to remember now, but those artists, especially Herring and Basquiat, had kind of faded. And there was some feeling that the party was over now. This has been reversed in the last couple of decades. But novels seemed the way to go with him. And then when it came time after we met to talk about Rumi, that I had sort of space to write this book, then I realized, well, I don't really like novels about famous artists. And then also with Keith, this sort of Guinness Book of Records of his career and life was so astounding. And this 10-year comet that he had, that I felt it was made a lot of sense to tell the story with the facts and also to fill in that time. So one thing that happened in the decades since his death is you could no longer say Club 57 or Mud Club and people would automatically know what you were talking about. And even AIDS, for young queer people, is not what it was like at that time, especially in the downtown art world. It's not often comprehended. So it was also telling the story of the time.
Yes, I mean, that was a time when people were talking about AIDS, but not the President of the United States. And now is a time when there are ads for HIV medications on TV. And yet, as you say, it's gone underground.
Yeah, it's amazing how the activism of Keith Haring, I mean, he was an activist, or some of his friends called him an artivist at the time, for all sorts of causes. And it was so much a DIY, do-it-yourself sensibility, I think. So as you were saying, it didn't seem like one person could change the second election of Ronald Reagan, even though Keith kept doing all these subway works that were anti-Reagan and get out the vote. But, you know, at the end of his life, AIDS then and AIDS activism becomes his main sort of mission. So he's doing it both. He's doing it in his art, making paintings like Silence Equals Death, and also as a member of ACT UP. He's one of the big supporters of ACT UP, and the treasurer of ACT UP, Peter Staley, told me that he used to go to Keith's studio and Keith would give him brown paper bags of cash that had like $10,000 in them. Peter would take them to the Citibank on LaGuardia Place and deposit it in the ACT UP account. And that in 1989, a third of the funds of ACT UP came from Keith Haring. Also, when he was diagnosed as HIV positive, then he gave a big interview with Rolling Stone, coming out as a PWA, a person with AIDS. And this was very much not what people were doing at the time. I mean, this was when Rock Hudson was dying of AIDS and pretending not, very publicly, when Roy Cohn kind of came back from the grave to insist that he had pneumonia or liver cancer, but not AIDS. So there were obituaries at that time. It seemed like everyone was dying of pneumonia, that rarely was AIDS mentioned, rarely were long-term partners mentioned. So he was a distinctive figure in articulating the messages about politics and social justice at the time.
And we might even get back to that point, but I want to turn now to back to the beginnings, actually, just a little bit. He was an artist from the start, even as a little kid. Tell us about where Herring came from and how that shaped him.
Well, he came from a town, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, near Allentown, Pennsylvania, a very small, white, conservative town, an unpromising seeming town for a major artist to come from. But actually, at the time, a number of important 20th century American artists came from similar unpromising towns in Pennsylvania. Franz Kline came from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, where I am from. Then Jeff Koons came from York County in the north. Alexander Calder had come from a small town outside of Harrisburg. Andy Warhol from a neighborhood in Pittsburgh. Heath's parents were, his father had been a Marine. He came from a Marine family. Although he had this, his father was also an amateur artist and cartoonist. And that turns out to be very important in Heath's life. His father sort of gets him or is encouraging him at drawing original cartoons from the age of four on. And then he's exposing him to Dr. Seuss and to Walt Disney. Since Keith later said that the great artists of the 20th century were Picasso, Warhol, and Walt Disney, this obviously left an impression on him. So he seemed, in that way, he was in a nurturing spot for his particular talent. And he just also from the beginning seemed to have this vocation. When he was in fourth grade, he wrote in an essay, "I would like to grow up to be an artist in France. I would be able to live by selling my drawings. I do hope that this happens." So he was one of those kids who from the single digits had this idea of being an artist. And he goes through these periods, which was actually fun and interesting to write because I'm like just 6 years older than Keith and also from Pennsylvania. And I just remember these waves coming through. Keith was very much a sponge in that way, as his dealer, Tony Shafrazi, later described him to me. So even as a kid, he was a Jesus freak. And then he had a period as a Grateful Dead head. And then he's taking, certainly, experimenting with pot and then acid. So the first time he draws abstract drawings or is a teenager in his room in Kutztown tripping. So all of that is kind of, like someone, an artist coming out of a moment in popular culture that we all remember and transforming it as he went along into higher and higher art, I guess you could say. He loved television. He loved cartoons. That kind of acid color of those color TV, early color televisions, is very much in his work. There's one thing that drew him to the subway graffiti artists who were working when he arrived in New York City, that they too were obviously so influenced by cartoons and pop and color television. So all of this he kind of transmogrified in a certain way, and you can watch him doing it.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our guest today is Brad Gooch, author of the definitive new biography, Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Herring. And you really put a whole lot there together in that answer. So I'm going to prise some of it apart. Your book is called Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Herring. And before we get to the radiant, the line that struck me, the life and line, because in a way, there is a through line from when he started drawing, as let's say an adolescent, and his later work, even though the later work is, as you say, much more mature, much more developed. What is that through line? How would you describe Keith Haring's line?
Well, it is. I mean, his sister did a graphic comic, like for kids, called "The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Drawing," and so he had that, and it was very much, you know, his base talent was drawing from the beginning, and it was kind of preternatural, and he would do these drawings of, when you watch him do it, the performance of it is fascinating, but also that he has it all in his head at the beginning. So he always kind of, you watch him working, kind of starts from the upper left side and does this kind of spider web going down to the lower right. And then when you're watching him, you realize that the only way he could make the designs that he's making is he has to already see it in his head, that there's a kind of spontaneity to it, but there's also a kind of forethought to it. And the other, when you say through line, I mean, it's an actual line. Keith loves to work, says that he's never happier than when he's working. And he has, it's not just a work ethic, but it's almost this need that goes on kind of 24/7. And it often makes it seem like it's just one line. I mean, he's starting, he's leaving off one work and he's going to another, and then he's drawing on someone's jacket. So he's finding his way. It's a little like Harold and the Purple Crayon, through the pages of his life. And he says, which is the epigram to my book, that your line is your personality. So he connects right there to that there's this intimate connection of his life and his work. It takes him a while to figure out how to turn that line into the kind of signature that we recognize today, where he really, at a certain point, after being in New York for a couple of years, begins drawing his crawling baby and flying saucers and nuclear reactors, ziggurat stairways, you know, all this imagery that he then recombines and tells different stories with from then on. And they become his basic language or his vocabulary. But it's always this line that drives the work.
And he said that his line is the personality, and that personality is radiant. So let's talk about radiant. Of course, radiant is the radiant baby, but it's also about him.
Right. Well, he had extraordinary energy. He was unusual, had a number of unusual traits, I think, for an artist. I mean, he was very generous in the sense that he was always curating shows, not just in the early days, not just trying to get his own work shown, but at Club 57, which was the kind of clubhouse of School of Visual Arts, he was always curating these different shows and inviting, or they'd be open shows, or inviting his friends to be in them. One of the most successful was the erotic art show he had. And Club 57 was located under a Polish church. Ann Magnuson, who was the bartender manager, told me that the bishop from upstairs came down to see the art show one night. She had to kind of steer him away from this big silver phallus, which was on the opposite wall. So Keith was always sort of livening things up and trying to create community in that way. And also his impulse to sort of cover the world with these drawings and lines and things was sort of a desire to tune things up, I think, or to keep bringing everything to a higher frequency. You know, like Coke adds life, Haring adds life. So he was, in that way, I said a scene maker, but of course he was also creating all this art that continues on the walls of museums, even to speak to us and to communicate this sense of life and this liveliness and this concern. Something else that pops into my head that connects to this later in life. I spoke to his doctor, and when he had AIDS, at that point, all the waiting rooms of these doctors' offices in New York were jammed. I remember my doctor, Dr. Starrett, you would walk in and there'd be people you recognize, like Robert Mapplethorpe in his wheelchair with this, but there, it would be standing room only of some very sick people. And you had this feeling about how did we get from those fun clubs to this crowded room? But this doctor told me that when Keith would come in, he would always sort of light up the room. And he said it wasn't because of his celebrity. It was because he had this quality that was contagious. He said radiant, for lack of a better word. So I think that lightening up of everything, intentional in his art, and somehow in his energetic presence, I was also referring to in radiant. And then, as I mentioned earlier, his kind of career. I mean, all this happened. I had to keep reminding myself as I was writing it. I mean, you would be in chapter 9, and Keith would be in the basement of his Broome Street studio with these rats running around and things. And then you'd be in chapter 10, and he's having a show in a museum in Europe. He's just like, it happened very, very fast.
Yes, and he really had a kind of he was part of, I think you call it a double art market. In other words, his public art, which he was very dedicated to. He believed in that art should be free, it should be for the people. He would even give away a lot of his art on the one hand, and then on the other hand, of course, he had a meteoric rise where his paintings would sell for tens of thousands of dollars. The reaction of the art world to him was extremely suspicious. And do you think it's because he straddled this line and they couldn't quite trust him because he was a public artist, a graffiti artist?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly at that time he was, crossing this boundary in so many ways that hadn't been crossed, or it had been. He was certainly by Andy Warhol, and Keith Haring was continuing it in a certain way. So one is this distinction between sort of high art and low art, like cartoons are low art, abstract paintings are high art, and museums and galleries are about that. Diego Cortez, who was a curator I talked to a lot, who did an important show, New York New Wave, around that time, said, the galleries in the 70s, like when Keith arrives in New York, were white rooms with white people drinking white wine. So it was a very kind of minimalist temperament and aesthetic at that time. And Keith did everything that he could do to to kind of blow that system apart, and that bothered people. The other was he started, as you said, he had this kind of slogan, art for everybody, and that was really a concept that was driving him, and part of finding a way to do this besides the subway drawings project. And after that, it died out for various reasons after about 5 years, including people ripping off, because he was now famous, cutting out the drawings and taking them upstairs to sell them, which wasn't his intention. He started something called the Pop Shop. And the Pop Shop was meant to, Leo Castelli, the dealer, said that it itself was a work of art. I mean, it was an immersive environment painted by Keith, and he sold there t-shirts that he saw as prints and pins and different sort of like a new genre of art merchandise. This sort of triggered a pretty fierce reaction, surprisingly, when you read back on some of the critics of that time. They're so vehement about all this. And one of them, Robert Hughes, who was the critic at Time magazine, powerful, had really targeted Haring and Basquiat. And he would call Haring Keith Boring, and he called Basquiat Jean-Michel Basket Case. He said that Keith was a disco decorator, So there was also a kind of homophobia, I think, that was at work in people's resistance to Keith and to his art. And he was drawing these big penises, which was the kiss of death at the time. You know, I mean, usually and certainly all the time that I was writing the book, I thought that this was a moment in history that we were well beyond. And I included a lot of that to try to communicate what the viewpoint was, how it could be so strident and worked up. And yet, since my book comes out, I've read a couple of reviews that are the same. I mean, they're sort of spend the time worrying about whether Keith was sold out. And there was a New Yorker piece, was Keith a brilliant artist or a brilliant brand? So actually, it's interesting that bringing together of art and capitalism, art and popularity, still can excite people. Not always positive.
Right. And I think what maybe bothered them was that he was selling art that anybody could afford. It wasn't exclusive to people who would pay thousands of dollars for it. And another thing that's interesting, I mean, he's, as you said, he talked about art for everybody. And he wasn't the only one who was talking about that at the time. I mean, I remember that time because, as I told you before we began today, my mother lived down there. She was part of the downtown art scene. She was a performance artist and dancer and choreographer, as well as a visual artist who incorporated all those things. And
And what was her name?
her name was Frances Alenikoff. She had her own dance troupe, but everybody was talking about, she was living, for example, in a building in which there were a lot of Fluxus artists. Nam June Paik was her upstairs neighbor. The Fluxus movement was also about artists for everybody, artists part of everyday life. And yet, I felt as being a non-artist at that time and just viewing all of this, that I didn't feel that much of that art was all that accessible, except for Haring's work, and actually, except for my mother's work. And the thing that united both their work in very different medium was that their work was narrative. I mean, he was telling a story. And I think a lot of people were not telling stories. They were doing art out in public, but there were no real stories attached to them.
Yeah, I mean, he got some of that. Interesting in writing the biography is how thoughtfully this young kid, Keith Haring, coming from Kutztown, was sort of putting together his ideas about art in his career, and really, taking courses at SVA that then informed his work, like semiotics. And that's where he got the idea about having your own vocabulary or your own language, which he creates. And he was also influenced by the Nova Convention, which was in the East Village in the late 70s, which was a tribute to William Burroughs. And Keith went, and it was one of the more profoundly affecting events because Burroughs had developed this idea of the cut-up, and that you would take language and you would cut it up on the page, and then you would get by chance, randomly, a different story being told. Keith then started doing this with his figures, and the same was true. So he said, I mean, if you have two babies crawling after a dog, is different than a barking dog crawling after one baby or something like that. So it depends how you arrange. So he would arrange and rearrange in some ways, but they were also like comic strips. So the comic strips, the likes of which no one had quite seen, but still familiar from that format. And just that your medium would resemble a comic strip. I mean, all this was Keith's desire to communicate. And he also said in an early journal, while he was still at School of Visual Arts, the message is the message. So sort of putting aside Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. Keith wasn't at all an ironic artist. He wasn't an artist of surface, and he was very interested in finding a way to communicate and communicate on these different levels that would include. So how do you include kids, and how do you include different socioeconomic backgrounds? How do you include the art people and the business people? And that was his mission, I think.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our guest today is Brad Gooch, author of the definitive new biography, Radiant, The Life in Line of Keith Haring. And he also had very deep relationships with Black and Latino graffiti artists, street kids, like LA2. You tell a great story in which, tell us who LA2 was, and a great story about him. This was a kid who was still in high school, maybe even not quite middle school. I think he was like maybe 14 or 15.
Yeah, he was 15 when he met him. So, yeah, I mean, LA2, Keith moves to the even lower east side at a certain point to Broome Street near Soho. And he's seeing around him all of, as I said, at that time on the subways, it was a high moment of the wild style of graffiti. So these subway cars were covered with big bubble lettering and all these kind of bright colors, yet de Kooning kind of scale, which Keith admired. He would just, instead of taking the subway, he would sit there on a bench and watch the trains go through. He, on the street, he keeps seeing this tag, which is the signature of a graffiti artist, which was LA2, and kept wanting to find out who he was and admired him. At one point, then Keith is invited to, where they're having a group of artists paint the courtyard playground of a public school, and someone there knows LA2, and it's this it's a kid, Angel Ortiz, who lived in the project nearby, and eventually brings their intermediary brings LA2 to meet Keith. Keith invites him to the studio at a certain point and asks him, he still at first doesn't believe, are you really LA2? And he has him draw paint on a surface, and then Keith starts kind of drawing around it. So they do a collaborative work in that way. And then he needs to go and have dinner with LA2's mom, because they divide the money on these works that they've done together. That Keith sold one for $1,200, I think. So she was sort of suspicious, since there was drug money going around, and what was her 16-year-old doing with this cash? And, you know, eventually it leads to, over a couple of years, Keith and LA2 doing a lot of work, sculptures together, paintings together. When he has his first show at the Tony Schiaffrazzi Gallery, LA2 and Keith have a basement, a black lit kind of display of all this work in the basement. Keith takes him with him to Tokyo, and they do varying kind of collaborative works. So he, you know, he had these connections, and he was very enthralled, especially with, you know, Black and Puerto Rican culture, I would say. And this had an erotic component too. I mean, his first boyfriend, Juan DuBose, was a Black DJ. His second boyfriend, Juan Rivera, was Puerto Rican. And Keith was very interested. I mean, I get asked the question about whether this was ripping off this, you know, different cultures and people, but it seemed more that he really desired to be part of that community. And he actually loved going and having dinner with Juan DuBose's family, or going to Harlem for Thanksgiving. And at some points it becomes a little too enthusiastic and naive. Like Keith writes at a certain point that I'm not really white inside, which is, you know, so there's a kind of, there's a naivete to it, and there's a we would now say a, you know, blinkered attitude towards his own entitlement. But I don't, it wasn't particularly conniving or mean. It just seemed to be part of his enthusiasms. And Keith was all about following his enthusiasms in an obsessive way. And he had been since he was a kid.
Now, I know you have to go soon. So I was really struck that there's a poignant vignette that you have at the end of the book. It's on the last full day of Keith Haring's life, when a friend tells him that he will do everything to see that Haring's legacy lasts. So I wonder if you could talk about Keith Haring's legacy, because so much of what he did is still absolutely relevant today. I mean, police brutality and, you know, it's maybe not AIDS, but now it is, you know, health disparities and Ronald Reagan you can supplant with Donald Trump. So tell us about his legacy and what he means for us today.
Yes, we need him. I mean, partly his legacy is there because he set it up. The part, and that I'm thinking of, that he set up a foundation. So very young, 28 years old, facing his own death, he set up a foundation, put up a board of directors, and assigned them, I mean, in certain way, you know, to protect his own work and legacy, but also to be this charitable organization that would give away money, especially to issues involving AIDS and young people. And that foundation has now given away over $43 million. So there's a way in which he set up a special kind of legacy for himself. And it says a lot about him. Other artists weren't setting up that kind of foundation. Also, he was taken up by a second generation of artists, and that's something that can't really be forced, I think. And I'm thinking of Kaws, Banksy, Shepard Fairey, and these were all artists who were, you know, activists and also interested in hitting a wider public with their work, and therefore with licensing and things. So I think in the same way that Haring had come to New York and looked at Andy Warhol as a kind of template and hero for what he wanted to do, you get now this other generation. There are a lot of young artists who look at Haring that way. Also, I spoke to, and it's in the end of this interview, at the end of the book, to Ann Temkin, who's the chief curator of painting and sculpture at MoMA. And she kind of apologized to me for the institution. I mean, while Keith was alive, no museum in America showed his work. MoMA didn't show his work. And they didn't buy work. So they kind of missed that moment. But she said, again, she felt the part of it was that it was certain radical artwork. It can take 30 years before people can really see what it is. And that happened with Monet's water lilies, happened with the abstract expressionist painters. And she felt, you know, Keith is kind of at that 30-year mark. And especially when you see the work in museums, you see that it's kind of enduring power separated from all of the 80s clubs and the music and the general confetti of it all. Especially now that it does seem very familiar that you have artists who are interested in, have Keith Haring missions of democratizing art, of creating their own kind of personal, original language and vocabulary, of working on any available surface, and certainly of activism and creating community. And this feeling in, you know, Keith's time felt distressing to them and to the Club 57 crowd, and New York could be difficult, and the politics was repressive, and yet they still acted out. And I think that we feel in a similarly stressful moment, and, you know, it's helpful to have not Keith Haring himself, then this sort of Keith Haring spirit alive, so that, I mean, he seems more than ever one of us. I mean, I think his work makes even more sense now than it made in the 80s.
Yes, I think you're right about that. And this is just such a beautifully written book. And so, boy, I think you recounted almost every detail of his life.
No.
It was a great read.
All right, thank you.
I really enjoyed it. Brad Gooch, as I've enjoyed talking with you, Brad Gooch, the book is Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring. Thank you so much.
Yeah, as always, it was a great conversation. Thanks.
Brad Gooch is a poet, novelist, and biographer. In addition to Radiant, he's also the author of biographies of Flannery O'Connor, Frank O'Hara, and the 13th century Persian poet Rumi. He's also the author of several other works, including ones of memoir, poetry, and fiction. Coming up after the break, we listen back to an excerpt from my 2017 interview with Gooch about his biography of Rumi, Rumi's Secret. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, transcripts, and extended interviews. In our first segment today, we spoke with Brad Gooch about his new biography, Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring. Now, let's listen back to an excerpt from my 2017 interview with Gooch about his biography of the 13th century Sufi poet, Rumi. It's called Rumi's Secret. Rumi's Secret is the title of your book, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. Orient us first to his place and time.
Well, he was actually 13th century Persian poet, and he was born in Central Asia in what's now Tajikistan. But this was a very tumultuous period. The map of his life covers 2,500 miles. At a certain point, his family leave Central Asia. Then their homeland is destroyed by Genghis Khan and the Mongols. And Rumi really winds up part of his life as a refugee and a migrant. And then finally is living in Konya, in what's now Turkey, where he dies in 1273.
A very turbulent time.
Very turbulent time. I mean, even our time is maybe moving there, but it's so far pales. So especially because of the destruction of the Mongols, who were the terrorists of their time, in a sense, really wiped out certainly this Persian civilization that had been Rumi's homeland. Scholars now say that it constituted a genocide of the Persian population. You had all of these kinds of displaced mystics and poets and everyone else scrambling around. And then in a second wave, the Mongols attacked Baghdad and killed the caliph, who was sort of both king and pope. And, you know, many Muslims thought that if you read the poetry and writing, they thought that this was the end of Islam at that point. So it was really an incredibly tumultuous period. And interestingly, though, in this period of dark political turmoil, then you also have this incredible exuberance in poetry and, you know, philosophy and mysticism and Sufism, all these activities were experiencing a kind of golden period.
Do you think there's a connection or not between the two?
I actually do. And then I also think in how Rumi speaks to us now, you know, part of it is for the ages. I mean, he's kind of articulating the sound of one soul speaking, and this is always going to be audible, I think. But in another way, that the period, and somehow his reaction to the period and the strength of his holding on to love and seeing connections between different people and different religions. I mean, all of this is extraordinarily relevant and was all part of his trying to survive, I think, not just physically, but morally and intellectually in this chaotic time.
Yeah, in fact, you talk about the resilience of, well, of Islam of his time and of Rumi himself. Mm-hmm. Say a little bit more about that resilience.
Well, he certainly, I mean, suffered a lot during his life and really found, and I mean, had a very important encounter with Shams of Tabriz in the middle of his life that transformed him. So you had a kind of midlife crisis and transformation in Rumi. But all the poetry that we know really comes after that. So after 40 years of age, he writes, you know, over 3,000 ghazal, which are like sonnets, over 2,000 rubaiyat, which are like quatrains, a six-volume spiritual epic in couplets, as well as talks. So he was a genius, and he was also using, though, poetry to try to, you know, work through his issues and survive and endure. And so his own, you know, resilience was connected to poetry as well as music and the whirling dance that we associate with him that he learned, I think, from Shams of Tabriz. So these were all, you know, very vivid, necessary kinds of practices for him. And I think explanation of his resilience. And also at that time, and then he was part, though, of a wider culture. I mean, there were Sufi thinkers saying what, you know, things similar to what Rumi was saying. There were Persian poets who were in a, you know, creating pearly lines in a very beautiful period. So he was part of a culture in that way. And I do think that these, especially Sufi lodges at this time, were almost outposts for this kind of spirituality, mysticism, and then just the culture of music, song, and poetry as part of religious practice.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm talking with Brad Gooch about his biography of the 13th century Sufi Muslim poet Rumi. I asked Gooch how Rumi's writings had survived intact during so many centuries of conflict.
This is very interesting. I mean, I think, it was almost accidental in a sense. Rumi, as an adult, lives in, as I said, Konya, Turkey, and it was part of a Seljuk empire, which was almost an outpost at that point of Islamic civilization. Probably no one called Rumi during his lifetime. The name meant from Rome, and that really meant because that part of the world was the old Roman Empire or the Eastern Byzantine Roman Empire. So the Seljuks in Turkey, where Rumi winds up, are living among a population that's mainly Christian, Greeks and Armenians, about 80% of that population. It's a kind of, efflorescence of this culture, and the Seljuks really aspire to be Persian, so they brought in this culture, but then it's all destroyed. I mean, soon after Rumi's death, the Seljuk Empire falls, and all of that is quickly lost. So you would sort of think that would be it. Part of it is that Rumi's son and then his grandson start an order, the Mevlevi order, around Rumi and his teachings and the whirling dervish practice, much in the way that I think around St. Francis of Assisi, the Franciscans really grew as a codified order after his death. And so this continues through, and then at a certain point in Europe, Goethe, the Germans pick up, you know, translate Rumi, and then in England you have what we now think of as Orientalists, but these kind of great Cambridge dons, Arbery and Nicholson, who spend their lives, devote their lives to translating Rumi's work. In America, the Transcendentalists pick up on him. Emerson translates a Rumi poem, and then eventually we get Robert Bly and Coleman Barks, closer to our own time, who retranslate Rumi in a kind of free verse, almost beat poetry mode in a sense. So somehow these poems have gotten to us. You could imagine it not happening at all, especially because of when we were talking about the tumultuous time. I mean, I traveled in that part of the world. I was in Aleppo, then, where Rumi studied at college or madrasa, the day the Syrian civil war broke out. And I was in Iran a couple of times. Now no one can go to Iran. But just seeing Aleppo, which was kind of intact from Rumi's time, you could really see the 10th century tower and mosque and the bazaar. And that's been demolished, you know, in the last few years. So when you see the kind of demolition and destruction that can take place in history, it's all the more remarkable that Rumi has made it through. But part of it is he was very much a public figure, almost a kind of saintly figure by the end of his life. And then when this order was put together, everything was preserved. I mean, anything Rumi wrote or touched in some way was preserved. A lot of it then was put away, such as his father's writings or the transcriptions of Shams of Tabriz talks. And these were not really found by scholars until the 20th century again. And they were in these Mevlevi kind of monasteries and libraries.
Well, that's such a fascinating story. So the word secret is in your title, Rumi's Secret. It seems to me like this is a many-layered word in your wonderful biography of the poet, the Sufi poet of love. Tell us some of the different meanings that secret means in this book.
Well, it's definitely one of Rumi's words, ser in Persian, which he loves and uses in many different ways, and almost has a kind of aesthetic of secrecy that has, you know, personal dimensions to him, has poetic dimensions, has religious, theological dimensions. One of the secrets, in a sense, is that he had this transformative relationship in the middle of his life with Shams of Tabriz. And at this point, Rumi is an established scholar. He has a family. He has posts at four different colleges. He's a jurist in the Hanafi school and, you know, well-known and respected. Shams of Tabriz is a 60-year-old kind of outlier mystic who's been traveling around the Middle East in search of wisdom his whole life. And they meet and have this kind of electric friendship. And then they go into seclusion, first for 3 months, then for 6 months. At some point, Shams of Tabriz disappears from Rumi's life entirely. There are rumors he might have been murdered, probably not true, but definitely, you know, leaves without a trace. But we don't, and Rumi has then changed. I mean, he, as he said, love stole my prayer beads and gave me poetry and song. or when your love inflamed my heart, everything was burned to ashes except love. I put logic and learning and books on the shelves and learned the art of poetry and song. In all these ways, he's talking about the transformation in which he changed from sort of traditional preacher, teacher to a poet and mystic. But we don't know exactly what happened in seclusion between Rumi and Shams of Tabriz. I mean, this is always then finally of great interest to everyone and always a little mysterious. And especially later in his life in the Masnavi, Rumi's epic, he talks often about not saying the name of the beloved and how explanations make many things clear. Love is only clear in silence. So this kind of reticence and discretion and not naming is all very different from our culture today. But it's, you know, in part of the personal secret of Rumi's life, in a sense, right?
But how shall we interpret that? You know, we have this modern awareness of the rights of LGBTQ, of, you know, people coming out. This is a relationship that was scandalous in a time when homoerotic relationships between men was totally accepted. Mm-hmm. What was different about this?
Yes, they did have a relationship that seems almost more modern to us. So the Persian civilization. First of all, the ghazal, these love poems, are usually written to boys, and they were usually cast as soldiers and wine stewards and things. And also in terms of education, there was on a kind of Plato-Socrates model, where there was an erotic charge to the teacher-student relationship, but it was sort of man-boy in that way. And that was all fine. You know, Rumi and Shams of Tabriz had an unusual relationship, which they obviously describe as love, but it was never, even to them, clear who was the teacher-student relationship of it. So Shams of Tabriz at one point says, I need to know, are we teacher and student? Are we friend and companion? Rumi said that someone once said, oh, I can't tell who's the lover and who's the beloved. Rumi was in his late 30s when he met Shams of Tabriz, and already a respected religious leader. Shams of Tabriz is 60. The kind of almost equality or parity between them was really what I think upset people. In a more traditional hierarchical society, they didn't actually fit. And also there was so much then chaos that ensued. I mean, Rumi had, because he was in middle age and he was successful, he had family, he had disciples, students, community. So all of this is put on hold in a way, which creates a lot of anxiety and confusion in everyone else. So there was a social disruption that occurred around, you know, Rumi's personal disruption because of the appearance of Shams of Tabriz. The other aspect, I think, is, and that's what's interesting about biography, is that the real story, in a sense, in actual people. I think if you were central casting, looking for a spiritual teacher, you would not come up with Shams of Tabriz. I mean, he was not the Buddha or something. I mean, there wasn't anything peaceful about him, and he was an irascible character, kind of misanthropic, had trouble getting along with his teachers. That was part of his wandering around, and didn't suffer fools lightly. He was only interested in Rumi, really. So none of this, he wasn't politic in the least, and was very interested in sort of honesty and openness between the two of them, and really would have liked, he said it many times, to have Rumi leave this life and go. They would go off together and wander and travel. That had been Shams of Tabriz's life. That was the life that you would choose if you were a young mystic and poet. But, you know, Rumi had this midlife transformation. And so he was, part of his struggle is trying to resolve these two. So, I mean, all this, I think, is the source of the upset of that relationship.
That was an excerpt from our 2017 interview with Brad Gooch about his biography of Rumi, Rumi's Secret. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to the rest of that conversation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.